Welcome on to a Wednesday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball podcast. Got a couple of games to wrap up here, including the end of the Memphis-Portland series and some big news as well out of Oklahoma City and Cleveland. And we're also going to get to some good questions using the Dunked On hashtags, which you can submit at any time. Danny, let's start with Memphis-Portland, actually, since it's fresh in our minds here. As I usually do, what's your global thoughts here on the game itself, and then also maybe getting into the global ramifications for the Portland offseason?
Okay, so we'll start with the thoughts on the game. I mean, it was pretty remarkable to me how important Mike Conley was, you know, to this team, and that they won anyway. It was one of those games where Portland had opportunities, they just didn't really maximize them, and something I know we'll talk about is that this was a rough series for particularly Damian Lillard, but for LaMarcus Aldridge as well, and Aldridge obviously had his injury issues, but you knew at the beginning of this series that those two players were going to need to carry them because they had a weaker starting unit and a decimated supporting cast because those guys got pushed up. And for reasons that a lot of which go to Memphis's credit, they did not do what was necessary for them to win this series.
Yeah, we said at the start that in Portland's weakened state, Lillard and Aldridge had to be the two best players in the series. They absolutely were not. You had a couple good stats on their performances.
Sure. So the most remarkable one to me, considering his prowess from that range, is that in the first four games, because they didn't have tracking available yet at the end of this game, LaMarcus Aldridge was shooting 16.5% from 10 to 14 feet, which is a range he usually does very well in, and just 27.8%, so just over 1 out of 4, from 15 to 19. So from the entire mid-range, he just struggled for the entire series. And a lot of the credit of that goes to Memphis. And then on the other side, you talk about Damian Lillard's sweet spot. He shot, including the last game, he shot 16.1% from 3. If you're making that few, it's going to be really hard to win, even against a substantially weakened Memphis squad.
That was remarkable how few of Aldridge's shots came in his probably potentially more efficient pick and pop. And I think a lot of that was due to the lack of spacing that Portland had through the first three games or so, with McCollum playing pretty miserably. Noah Fallo, although he wasn't even really able to do much when he did get back in there, obviously no Wes Matthews. So Memphis was able to collapse and not give up that pick and pop, which a lot of times is the poison that the other team will have to pick with Dame doing the pick and roll and all those shooters around him. Memphis was able to take that away. A lot of it ended up just being tough post-ups for LaMarcus against Zach Randolph. And as we talked about yesterday, so much of post-defense is using your body. Zach Randolph can't jump over a phone book, and yet he's still an excellent post defender on LaMarcus in this series.
Yeah, Zach Randolph's play in this was really just a huge factor in it. And as we said, he makes LaMarcus work for everything. And that was a factor that went the other way, particularly with Damian Lillard and his susceptibility to back cuts and just mistakes on defense, allowed Memphis to get easy looks. And when you're missing your point guard especially, you need those easy looks to sustain yourself through the dry spells.
That said, Portland was right there until the end. Yeah. They were down one, and then the Grizzlies hit him with a 9-0 run, I think, to go up 85-75. And that was with an interesting lineup. Tony Allen was really effective in this game, but by that point, McCollum and Lillard were really tired out. They both played essentially the entire second half, and with about 5 minutes left, they were out of gas. They couldn't get anything going, and Memphis had more of an offensive lineup with Courtney Lee out there, and who was the other shooter? Was it Carter? Oh, no, it was Jeff Green. Jeff Green, Courtney Lee, both out there, spreading the floor just a little bit more, and the Grizzlies were able to score efficiently in that period, and that was about it. The biggest issue that I saw in this game, though, was Terry Stotts started with the normal starting lineup. Did you agree with me that that was as egregiously bad as I thought?
Yeah, I did, and I mean, Aflalo just wasn't there. And there's talk among, especially among the analytics community, that his stock is too high anyway, stock's inflated. considering my history with him. I can't say that even I went to college with him and all that, but I'm just too biased. I openly admit my bias with Aaron Aflalo. But he wasn't there in the series at all. And so to start him, I think you're digging yourself a hole. And then what we saw in the last couple games of the series, and you and I have talked about it before, is that Myers-Leonard broadly outplayed Robin Lopez. And so they put themselves in a hole that was hard to get through. And you saw it with the way that the minutes turned out. I mean, you had two guys that started and played less than 20 minutes despite collectively having four fouls.
Yeah, I understand. Let me start with this caveat before I really lay into Terry Stotts here on this. I understand the anchoring that occurs. This is a team that has had a great starting lineup. You had four-fifths of that still intact, with Matthews the only one who is missing. But you had 3.5 games that lineup was basically getting smoked. And finally, for the first time in the series, you find something with Myers-Leonard playing at center, spacing the floor, and C.J. McCollum also out there starting to get hot a little bit. You come back, you miraculously win game four. Just start those guys. You got nothing to lose. You're on the road in a game five, still down 3-1. You finally found something. You have a ton of evidence already that those guys don't work. I was very surprised that they started the same lineup. And, of course, they got smacked right away. They were down 11-1, 15-6 when Stotts finally went with McCollum and with Leonard. And, of course, they get right back into it, tie the score at 20 at the end of the quarter. Third quarter, I tweeted at the end of the half, if Stotts goes with the same starting lineup, like I basically was going to be apoplectic about it. And, of course, he did, 6-0 right at the start, and then he goes with those guys. And, you know, how can you not see that coming? I mean, it's rare that when you don't play your best lineup, it's confirmed that quickly and that easily. But it really was. I mean, it's about the most obvious thing that you could see. And so Stotts, unfortunately, basically punted 15 points in this game just by not starting his best lineup.
And it wasn't an issue in terms of how those guys had played early in the series of a sample size bias, you know, a bench guy dominating against bench guys, and then you bring them into the starting lineup and they get smoked. Myers-Leonard had played well against Marc Gasol. He forced Marc Gasol to do things he was uncomfortable with, and C.J. McCollum plays generally without fear, so that is an asset against this Memphis team. And he also forces the Grizzlies without Conley to make some challenging defensive choices. I mean, do you put Tony Allen and Courtney Lee? Do you slide both of them down and then force whoever the third perimeter player is to guard Batum? I mean, you make things more difficult on Memphis, but when you're playing Aaron Aflalo or you're doing other things, then you're giving Dave Yeager a lot of latitude when he didn't need that because he already had the talent advantage.
So that was disappointing. A couple of other points here. Memphis dominated the offensive glass. They're at about 35% offensive rebounds. They got 15 offensive rebounds to 33 defensive rebounds for Portland. So that was big for Memphis, since really the team shot about the same in this game. C.J. McCollum did have a wonderful game. His jumper was just on fire. Wasn't even hitting the rim on his threes. He made his first five threes with the exception of, or the, his first, he was 5 for 6 at one point, and all of his makes, he missed only one at the end of the quarter. That was it. And that was a heave. He was making all of his other shots. I guess the question now going forward, I mean, I don't think the Blazers were going to win the series, no matter what they did, you know, carp about the lineups, whatever. What do we think about CJ and Leonard now with how they finish these series? Flash in the pan, they're young guys. Are they really going to be part of the foundation here, or is the jury still out on that?
I think that they're part of the foundation, but they're not part of the core. So they're useful pieces to have. They're guys that have a role in this league. But when I see C.J. McCollum, I don't think starter. I think very useful sixth man, seventh man, which is great. You need guys like that. Myers-Leonard, it's a balancing act. I like that his offensive game. I think that the idea of two bigs that can shoot as well as Aldridge, assuming he returns, and Myers-Leonard is very interesting. The problem with that is defensively. Because to me, when you're playing a guy, and I'm sure we can talk about this later, is as defensively flawed as Damian Lillard is right now, to me, you have to have somebody who can credibly defend the rim to dissuade those shots, because otherwise you're just going to have a layup line, basically. And even though Portland often plays Wes Matthews, who's a good defender, and Batum, who's overrated but still, you know, not terrible, that mitigates it a little bit but doesn't mitigate it enough. So yeah, my answer, it feels a little bit like a hedge to me, but it's that they're not there, but they're still important. Do you agree?
Yeah, I do. I'm slightly less sanguine about their prospects, I think, than you are, especially with CJ. I still don't see him being able to get to the basket and finish in most situations. And I think he's still really dependent upon his mid-ranger. The way he shot the three was very nice. So maybe if he becomes really more focused on shooting the three. But he's not really much of a passer still. He's not really much of a finisher. And defensively, he's always going to be a liability at the two and probably not quite a good enough passer to play the one. And if you're going to run with Dame and Myers Leonard and CJ all out there, and maybe LaMarcus if he's still around, and Batum, going to be pretty darn difficult to have that be a good defensive lineup. That was their best lineup in this series, clearly, because Memphis, not a ton of dynamic penetrators, not a ton of shooting. They're able to defend them okay. But, yeah, I mean, Leonard, a little bit of a space cadet defensively still. I was at a game in Portland where Trevor Booker put up 35 on him or something like that at a career high when Leonard was playing as kind of a stretch four to start with Aldridge out. And I don't think he's someone who's incredibly intelligent, at least at this point in his career, at understanding the defensive schemes. That's not his reputation as a cerebral player. So I'm not sure whether he ultimately ends up being a good enough defensive player. And then offensively, he doesn't do enough big man things that you can't just guard him with a wing. And then if you have to have him guard a wing on the other end, you're at a big disadvantage.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. And to me, that's why both of them are more bench players than starters, because what I like to think about with a guy is, do his skills work against high-level competition? And for me, at this point with them, neither one of them really does. You know, they're change of pace guys. They're not the lead. And, you know, that there's nothing really wrong with that, but that makes it really difficult to build around them. And that goes into one of the questions we got tonight, which is, do you think that Portland, if it's from Buckets NBA, do you think that Portland re-signs Robin Lopez this summer with Myers Leonard's emergence?
All depends on the money for Lopez, right? That's one issue. He didn't have the greatest series, but also he's been very important to the foundation of their defense, protecting the basket. They love to force teams into taking mid-range shots. He'll hang back on the pick and roll. They just made a lot of progress this year forcing teams to take inefficient shots. And that's how they were able to get a lot better defensively. You wonder how much of that was a fluke given the overall defensive talent on this roster. So, you know, I think obviously the biggest thing that's going to matter is what happens with LaMarcus. If LaMarcus comes back, maybe you bring back Lopez as well or some other equivalent, but you'd be hard-pressed to replace him if Aldridge signs for the maximum. So if I had to guess, I think he probably would be back. He's emerged as a starter. I think he likely had some affection for Portland, and I don't know that they can find a really superior replacement, but on the other hand, he's not exactly a panacea for them at that position either.
Yeah, what makes Portland such a challenge from a GM perspective is that they have a ton of free agents, which sometimes people think of as, oh, that's a nice thing. That means they have a lot of flexibility. But with the way that cap holds are structured, that doesn't really mean that in terms of Portland. The only way they get cap flexibility is if guys leave. And if that happens, then you're in a different situation. So that's why, to me, like you said, it goes back to LaMarcus Aldridge. Because if Aldridge leaves, then you have the space and the flexibility to make more wholesale changes if that's what you want to do. if he comes back, you can't really do big things, especially if Wes Matthews comes back as well, though he will presumably be on more of a make-good contract considering his Achilles injury. You're in a tough spot because if you lose one but keep, let's say, two of the other guys, then you're in an even stickier spot because then you have some guys. And then the other major factor with this is Aaron Fowle has a $7.5 million option and a player option. And I think he's going to opt out, but his stock does not seem super high right now. And I could see him thinking that teams are going to spend like drunk sailors in 2016 and he could just pick up something there and just take his sure $7.5 million now and wait.
Yeah, and I'll need to go back and look at exactly what those numbers are. It's been a little while since I looked at their cap situation, so we'll get into that in much greater detail, obviously, as we get into free agency with all these teams, as we're kind of talking about what things look like. But, you know, we still have the playoffs going on. It's kind of more interesting to focus on that. Let's, a couple other notes here, in this game. One is that poor LaMarcus, just that left hand wasn't working for him. He missed three really easy lefty layups. He took the brace off his hand at one point. We forget, too, that he was playing with injuries on both thumbs, and it's pretty darn hard to play basketball when you're without opposable thumbs that work. That's pretty important to holding things and doing things with the ball. So we should remember that he decided to forgo surgery. That was thousands and thousands of injury years ago for the Blazers at this point, but he decided to do that and thought that this team might be a championship contender at that point. So when you think about his free agency, remember that he decided to do that to try and make it work in Portland. Even if he decides to move on, he gave his all to this team.
He certainly did and deserves, I don't know if it's credit, but praise for making a really selfless decision when he's going into free agency.
Agreed. A couple other totally random notes. It's time to retire this whole, if you're ahead, you shouldn't commit a foul thing because the other team has a chance to score with the clock stopped. If somebody's going in for a layup, you're better off giving them a hard foul, even if you're up, and making them earn the 2 points. It doesn't take any more time off the clock to shoot a layup. You know, you're not saving any time for the opposition by fouling them. Just take the foul. The whole, like, they're scoring with the clock stopped just needs to be retired.
I completely agree, and actually would... If something I've been thinking about for a while and haven't mentioned this to you online or offline is I think that a team like the Warriors who have Curry, who's a magnificent foul shooter, and Klay Thompson could consider more aggressively fouling with the lead because if the goal is to get in, if the other team is going to be forced to foul, then waiting a little bit, obviously you don't foul as soon as the other team gets the ball, but if you wait a little bit and do that, I think as great as the Warriors' defense is, it increases your win probability even if it by decreasing the variance, I guess would be the way to put it.
Right, so explain what you're saying. You're saying if the Warriors are up, they should foul the other team?
Yeah, so like let's say the Warriors are up 4 with, well, I'm trying to think of a time, like 40 seconds left or something like that. That you
get to like prevent them from getting a 3.
Yes. So not the whole...
And getting closer. Yeah, that's been suggested. And I think they even do that sometimes in Europe.
Yeah, I've seen it. I think I've seen it happen in Europe, but I've never seen an NBA. I can't remember ever seeing an NBA team deliberately do the free throw contest when they're in the lead.
Yeah, well, I mean, other than just in the last when the shot clock's off and trying to get a 3 to tie and you force them to shoot 2 free throws instead. But yeah, no, it's something to consider. I mean, it's pretty unconventional. I wouldn't expect that we would see that necessarily, but it's a thought. The other thing that I just thought is kind of hilarious, and I really chuckled at, is at one point LaMarcus missed an easy layup, and right after he did, you could see him like almost go to intentionally foul. I think it was Zach Randolph, and then he suddenly like he even made contact with him, and then he suddenly just put his hands back, like okay, I'm not doing this. But it says something about the human condition that your first instinct after missing an easy layup is just to immediately foul whoever got the rebound, like. But, and I don't know why we do that. Like, I've done that. I've felt like, you know, been playing games, missed the layup, and then just, like, fouled the guy for no reason. And it's just like, maybe you're frustrated, or you just, you know, mentally you're exhausted, or you don't want to have to get back on defense, or I don't know what it is, but it's really weird to me that people do that.
Yeah, I did one this past weekend. I played a pickup game and did something very similar to that. And from what I recall, didn't Chris Paul do that yesterday?
Yeah, he did. I mean, he didn't miss a layup, but he was, yeah, that was the play where he got them in the bonus that we talked about.
The Kawhi Leonard box out.
Oh, no. I was talking about when he missed, because Kawhi got the score there. No, I'm talking about you miss your own layup.
Yes, and then I know.
Yeah, so anyway, why don't we move on to what was a little bit better of a game, more interesting in my eyes, since I thought this Portland series was kind of like fait accompli. Once we found out about all the injuries, this Atlanta-Brooklyn game, I felt like the big theme here was just things reverting back to normal, basically. The Hawks started hitting their shots. Seth Partnow had a nice piece today on B-Ball Breakdown showing that the Hawks were basically getting about the same shots that they got during the regular year, just not hitting them. Millsap and Horford in particular with his mid-rangers. Horford was shooting like 25% on mid-rangers, and he's one of the best in the league during the regular year. And guess what? Al Horford started hitting his mid-rangers in this game, and we finally saw then down the stretch the Hawks start killing the Nets as we thought they would, with Horford in the pick-and-roll and Brook Lopez unable to get out on his mid-range shot. Then when he finally did get out on it, Teague was able to drive by him for a layup. And I think the Hawks scored four straight possessions down the stretch using a Teague-Horford pick-and-roll.
The pick-and-roll was definitely the big story for me, and I think you phrased it really well in terms of regression to the mean. I think that Atlanta hadn't been making the plays that they usually make, and you can see how that can add up. Though the Nets did have some runs in this game that were challenging, one of the other things, as somebody who covered them for a while, is we also saw a good Jarrett Jack and bad Jarrett Jack. And that is hard for coaches because he has these great moments, but you have to be ready for his supreme confidence to turn into a negative because he thinks he can do everything.
Yeah, he started off, I think he had a run of, 12 points in a row early in the fourth quarter. And Lionel Hollins, kind of more of an old school guy. One of the real old school principles is the idea of being really hot. And so he continued to milk Jack. And as someone tweeted, names escape me at the moment, the Nets had zero passes on five straight possessions as Jack continued to live up to his name and not pass the ball. And he took some real bad ones down the end. He had one jumper blocked by Teague. He took a quick three, which actually wasn't a bad shot. They were down six with about a minute left, and he had an okay look there. The well ran dry for him, as you might have expected it to for veteran Jarrett Jack watchers like ourselves.
Yeah, I guess that's the right way to put it. Oh, God, it's hard for me because I was consistently surprised that the Nets were even in this series. So I guess that goes to the regression of the mean thing that we were always talking about. But they had some really good moments in this game.
Another thing I liked in this game was that Coach Bud is starting to figure the playoffs out a little bit. We were critical of him for playing his bench maybe a little bit too much, basically sticking with his regular season rotations. And Pop can do that in San Antonio. He's had success, but frankly, they have a much better bench than the Hawks do at this point. And even Pop has had to now extend guys like Duncan and Leonard, who are really the two irreplaceable guys on that San Antonio team. Those guys are now playing well over 35 minutes in a lot of these games. So the key was Budenholzer went back to his starters very early on in the fourth quarter. Usually he'll have Horford and Korver out there for a stint across the end of the third, beginning of the fourth, and take both those guys out and put them back in. He didn't do that. He basically went with his starters for just about the entire fourth, and that paid off. They stanched the bleeding on an 11-0 run. The Nets had an 11-0 run to start the second and an 11-0 run to start the fourth, and they were able to keep things under control. Another thought that I had here was the Hawks were just getting good shots and getting good offense, and while the Nets were able to come back, They were doing it with Jarrett Jack heroics. They were doing it with tough contested Joe Johnson threes. And eventually the probabilities worked out and the Hawks are a better team than the Nets, and especially on offense. And these last two games, the Hawks have looked like the Hawks offensively, especially when they've gone with their starters, and now they're back in control.
Doesn't that also tie in with Deron Williams having more of a Deron Williams game this time?
Yeah, it does. And we basically talked about it that we didn't think that he'd reach some incredible new level. And there are a lot of stories about, oh, well, now he proved he's the guy. He was so motivated after playing so poorly, and Hollins gave him a pep talk and all that. And no, he was still basically taking the same shots that he's been taking. He took more of them. He made them. But it's not like he was just unbelievable, getting to the rim, unstoppable. He hit his shots, and he reverted basically back to what he had been in the regular season and in the first couple games of this series in this game.
Yeah, I agreed on all counts. And another factor in this series, as much as I love the guy, is that Dennis Schroeder has not done particularly well. He struggled creating, he struggled shooting, and I talked about it earlier in the series that both Schroeder and Bazemore have been substantially below their shooting baselines, which is very challenging for the Hawks as a secondary unit because they need that respect from the defense in order to create. Would you consider playing Shelvin Mack more minutes?
I would, and part of the reason for that is that Schroeder plays a lot of his minutes with Horford and Korver when they come back in that kind of middle period of the half. And those are two good offensive players that you can go to against bench units, but not if Schroeder's just throwing the ball all over the gym. And he had one play, I think, when Bud finally gave up on him, was when he ran a pick and roll, had Horford just wide open at the free throw line, and instead just careened into three guys and tried to throw a wild cross-court pass that got picked off. And that, at that point, I think Mack is someone who can shoot the ball from the outside a little bit better than Schroeder. And he also is going to be steady, not turn the ball over. And also he's a better matchup defensively against Jack, because Jack is a guy, he's not going to beat you with quickness. He's just going to kind of take his time, get to his spots, use his strength, and then pull up for a mid-ranger. And Schroeder, being as slight a build as he is, isn't really able to stop that. He isn't really equipped to deal with the veteran tricks. So I would give Mack a shot. Maybe it doesn't work out. Schroeder was better than Mack in the regular year, but in this particular matchup, I think that Mack might be a little better option because Schroeder, they've just gotten killed every time he's been out there in this series.
Yeah, and another thing that, as you talked about, that has changed the dynamics is that they don't have Tabo at all, and that makes it harder. I would even consider just playing more of a bench unit and just hoping to ride it out. That's a very strange strategy for somebody like me to say, but considering the way that he impacts it when he's in and how well Teague played in this game with Horford, I'm not sure that I would want to separate them and just risk it in that sense.
Maybe the biggest part of this, and we touched on it already with sort of the reversion, but Al Horford was Al Horford again, maybe for the first time in this series. He had 5 offensive rebounds, 5 assists, was really all over the place. He stole an inbounds. He was really just, his activity level was outstanding. He was 10 out of 17, ended with 20 points, 15 rebounds overall, and he totally killed the Nets down the stretch. And he was the difference. He was the best player on the floor tonight, and that's why they won. He was the biggest part of it, at least.
Yeah, I agree. Anything else in this game, or do you want to move to news?
Why don't we move on? We got a lot of stuff. Let's start with Kevin Love. I guess we'd like to thank the Cavs PR department for giving us new news on Love so that media schlubs like us have something new to talk about 3 days in a row. But he is now out 4 to 6 months after shoulder surgery. So what do you make of this? For the Cavs' chances, we talked about it already that, you know, it wasn't looking like he was going to be back at all in the playoffs anyway. But so now we're really into the long-term ramifications here. What are they?
Well, so if we're talking beyond this playoffs, I actually don't think it affects that much. because it's, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, please do, I don't think this is an injury that will have long-term, you know, this isn't one of those things like an Achilles where we worry about it for a while, or microfracture where we worry about it for a while. It is an inconvenience, and I don't think it affects the market for him very much, because even at the late end of that six-month timeline, that's right, you know, right at the beginning of the regular season, and I think that any team that is looking to get Kevin Love is not looking to get him for November of 2015. They're looking to get him for, at the earliest, March and April of 2016. So I don't think it affects his market too much. It'd be funny if the only team that it made reticent was the Lakers, considering the Lakers aren't going to do anything next year anyway. But I don't think it affects a whole lot, except for this year's playoffs, which, as we talked about yesterday, it changes quite a bit.
Well, it is interesting to look at that 4 to 6 month timeline. The end of that timeline puts it basically right at the start of next year's regular season. If he had delayed surgery and tried to rehab and seen whether he could come back, but then maybe he's not as desirable of a free agent if he is going to potentially miss the start of the year, if he tries to rehab and then has to have his surgery and then misses his 4 to 6 months. So that's something, if you're trying to read the tea leaves, you might say, well, if he wants to get a new contract with another team, they want him available right at the start of the year. Or at the very least, if he just wants to keep his options open, that's one. So a couple of questions on this matter. One from Jermaine Jones, and his handle is Jermaine611. What are your thoughts on the career Love had with the Cavs? Maximum troll here from Jermaine, assuming that his Cavs career is over. What do you think the chances are his Cavs career is over and Jermaine's actually right here?
Well, so I wrote a piece a couple of years ago for Real Jam, which I called The Third Contract, and the story in that article was that that's when we really find out what somebody values, and that is even more true now than it was when I wrote it, because there are a lot more teams now that have space, and with the relatively low individual max contract, I think that's still true. If Kevin Love's goal is to win, to compete for championships, he will not have a better situation than Cleveland. He's just not going to sign somewhere. It's not going to happen. If his goal is something else, then he could do that. What I expect from him is the contract that I call the LeBron special, which is that he signs a one-year deal with a player option. I think Cleveland would be okay with that. I think that he would do that, and that way he gets the money that he wants for this year and gets to go out in that class, and so he gets another year with his Cleveland core. And why Cleveland would like it is it's brutally hard to replace him this year, but it would be substantially easier for them to replace him in 2016. So I think that's a solution that works for everybody. I don't think he's a guy who's going to freak out about his long-term value. So I'd say it's hard to put a number on it, but I'd say 2 and 3, 3 and 4 chance he's back with Cleveland next year.
That's possible. There was an article by Chris Haynes who moved to Cleveland and is covering the Cavs, used to cover the Blazers. And he talked about how Love's demeanor was so much more upbeat. He was so happy after that great game 3 that he had. And he was really enjoying being in the playoffs. And it was so unfair that he, you know, this ended up happening to him. And, you know, that's a good point. It really is unfair. And too bad this is his first time in the playoffs after years in NBA purgatory in Minnesota. But so that, you know, if that's to be believed, he might indicate that he feels like he has unfinished business in Cleveland and, you know, he wants to win and he was enjoying it and he felt like part of the team. On the other hand, we've talked about how NBA players sort of want to feel a self-actualization, that all of their skills are being utilized, that they can be a dominant player if that's what they have done. And that's what Love was in Minnesota at times. So I don't think he's ever going to be that in Cleveland, and not even from a statistical standpoint, but more just the way he's used, getting more touches, getting a chance to pass, be involved in the offense. And maybe that's something that David Black could hope to work in more in future years. And that might be a discussion that they have when he's talking about coming back. But, you know, I think that's the biggest reason why, he may not want to necessarily stay there. But also, you know, he may be at the point now where teams will be scared of the shoulder. He's had some knee problems, some back problems. He also didn't have that great of a year this year. And if he has one more year like this year, getting that big max contract may not happen for him. So, especially if part of the reason is injury related. So, he may want to see if he can't find that 5-year max deal now, or at least maybe get a little bit longer of a deal for some long-term security. And these are all competing considerations. We don't know what he's going to choose, but we can kind of just try and figure out what the factors are going to be. And I think that that risk may be slightly underrated by some, although I also think it's quite possible he does the 2-year, second-year player option outline that you picked as well.
Yeah. One thing I'd like to throw out there that I haven't mentioned anywhere before is that if Love takes the one plus one, which is what I think he's going to do, obviously there are other considerations, size of the market, quality of life, everything like that, but if they miss out on the other guy that they want, a place that would be very fun for Kevin Love, considering what he wants in terms of complementary talent, would be his dad's former team and go to the Washington Wizards. Because John Wall would work beautifully with Kevin Love. He's not a ball. He's not a shooter in that sense. And Beal and Love and Wall, to me, would be a really fun core, particularly in the Eastern Conference, that even at that point, let's say in 2016, 2017, unless Durant leaves there, it's not going to have that real dominant team in that sense.
Houston could be another possibility. They can always clear some space out for him. They reportedly have coveted him for a very long time. So that's another thought. I think there'll be a little bit more in terms of touches for him in Houston, with Dwight not getting nearly as many post-ups as he once did. So that's a thought as well. Let's move on now to the other big news encapsulated in our question from Ill Wildcat. The ill is capitalized. Thoughts on Billy Donovan hiring, and if there are better candidates available now or possibly in the future. Danny, go first.
Well, I'm somebody who thinks that the best coach for them is Alvin Gentry, so that would answer that they would have better options in the future. Billy Donovan is a very good basketball coach, but I do not have sufficient information to tell you that he is going to be or will not be a very good NBA coach. Those are very, very different things. And as is an issue with almost anybody who's going into something that unknown, this is a very strange time to take this kind of risk. Kevin Durant is a free agent after one season. Russell Westbrook and Serge Ibaka are free agents after two. There is nothing that the Thunder can do to secure their futures because of the way the extension system works. So they're making a very compelling bet. I don't think it's a particularly smart bet because I don't know. It could exist. I don't know of any personal relationship between Billy Donovan and any of those three. I have heard that he has one with the front office in Oklahoma City, but
yeah, and they actually hired already two guys out of the Florida program. One as a stats analyst, and the other to coach the D League team. So conspiracy theorists would think that this actually has been in the works for a while, or you know, perhaps they just respected him. Who knows? But yeah, I mean, there is certainly a relationship there, it would seem.
What do you think about Billy Donovan as an NBA coach?
I think that there definitely were potentially better options out there, Gentry being one. And if we haven't said this already, it bears repeating that Alvin Gentry would be able to fix their biggest problem, which is kind of a lack of ball movement, a lack of complexity, a lack of read and react on offense. And so he has a nice history of being able to install those type of systems, to work with point guards. So I think he would have been great. Of course, he would have had to wait until the Warriors season is over to do that, and he probably also would not exactly come cheap, though you would imagine that Donovan's not going to come cheap either. He's making like $4 million at Florida. He doesn't have a huge buyout. I think it's only $500,000, I read. But it's just, you're right, it's a risk. You're not getting a guy who has any kind of a track record of fixing the issues that are needed. College coaches are not exactly known for the complexity of their offense. You know, they have a 35-second shot clock. Donovan, I think, is probably better if you had to pick a college coach. I think he's one of the best, and he also has a history of coaching like the U19s and FIBA. He's done a nice job there, so that uses the 24-second clock there, kind of well-respected by USA Basketball and D dealing with players in a non-college environment where, you know, things are a little different. You don't have all the power over them. So I think if you had to pick a college coach, he's one of the best potential hires, but why did you have to pick a college coach?
Yeah, and if you're, I mean, and this is going to be high praise, especially granted it lingers in my mind that his team beat my school in two straight Final Fours, but if I had to pick a college coach, especially now that Brad Stevens is out of college, to be an NBA coach, I would pick Billy Donovan. But that doesn't mean that I would give Billy Donovan this situation, because the Oklahoma City team has so much talent on it and has such a steep learning curve. People talked about David Blatt and LeBron and all that. I actually think in a lot of ways, this Oklahoma City job is a tougher assignment because the window is 1 year. And he's making a really big jump, just like David Blatt did. And people talked about, oh, you know, he's coming over from Europe. I would say, and I think you'd agree with me, that there are more similarities between the jobs that David Blatt has had than what Billy Donovan has to do, where he doesn't get to recruit his players. They aren't committed to him in that sense. And all of the rule changes that also make college such a frustrating calibrator for evaluating guys as NBA talents.
Yeah, it's definitely a great point there. And we'll see. Oklahoma City has had some relatively puzzling moves of late. I mean, they acquired two guys in Waiters and Cantor who really were reviled by anyone who follows much in the way of analytics or just watching film of people playing defense. And Waiters isn't really even an efficient guy, and I don't think that either of those guys really worked out too well. Cantor got his stats, but, you know, their defense was atrocious once Ibaka went out, and maybe those acquisitions, you could say, had a fair amount to do with them missing the playoffs, especially when you consider the opportunity cost of potentially going in another direction to get a guy who might have fit a little bit better defensively. So, and now, you know, you got to wonder, too, if they do hire Donovan, and we haven't, that's not totally confirmed yet, but Mark Stein reported basically that it's close to a done deal and it would be a shock if he backs out at this point. So what does that mean for Enes Kanter's future? That's another thing. What are Donovan's philosophies that we're going to see? What kind of assistant coaching staff is he going to have around him? NBA defense is such a different animal than college defense is. You really, with the extra spacing, the defensive 3 seconds, the 24-second clock, it's going to be a tough adjustment, a real tough adjustment, and he is not going to have much time to get it right.
Yeah, he really isn't going to have that much time to get it right. One of the questions that I thought was interesting that we got is, we actually got a couple of them, I believe. The one that I saw was from Ill Wildcat, who I believe we had another question from, but there were a couple on it, is the prospect of a Hawks-Wizards second-round series and the odds of the Wizards making at least the Eastern Conference Finals.
Whew. Yeah, that's... I still would pick the Hawks in that series, I think. I'm not as scared of that Washington small lineup against the Hawks as you might have been against Toronto. I think the Hawks have much more discipline defensively. They're going to take advantage of some of the weaknesses of Washington's players. I do think it is a little bit of a concern for that small lineup that Paul Millsap has been so ineffective in his isolations. He hasn't been able to score at all against Joe Johnson. And, you know, to me, I think a big guy like Millsap, Joe Johnson is a stout guy. But if you're Millsap, like, he's trying to face up and do all this skill stuff, just put him in the goal. Basically, back him down and force help. If you're a big, strong power forward like Millsap, you should be able to do that when you have a wing on you. And whether it's just because that's not his philosophy anymore or because his shoulder isn't feeling well or whatever, he hasn't been able to do that. So I'm not sure if the Hawks can punish that Washington small lineup quite as well. You know, they might be able to put Pierce on Millsap or Otto Porter and do okay. But I also think Porter and Pierce are going to regress quite a bit with their shooting, especially now that they're being competently guarded by the Hawks, who are pretty disciplined and are not going to make things nearly as easy as Toronto did on the defensive end. So I think I like the Hawks in that series, especially with the home court, but it could be a dogfight. I think right now, assuming the Hawks come through in the next game and win in Brooklyn, I would probably go Hawks in six in that series, but, you know, I'll hold my official pick in abeyance until the Brooklyn series actually wraps up.
Yeah, I think that Washington's defense, particularly having John Wall, who's one of the better point guard defenders in my opinion, would definitely hurt Atlanta's ability to do some of the things that they want to do offensively. But I also think that Washington's offense would be a tire fire in that series. I just don't have faith that they will be able to make the adjustments and just really be able to do what they want to do against Atlanta, because Paul Pierce can do a lot of things well, but I feel like Millsap will do a better job on him than whatever it is that Toronto kept on was trying to do. I also think that the Raptors just, it looked like they were kind of defeated from early on. Like, you know, it was one of those series, and I don't think you're going to get that from the Hawks at all. You know, the Hawks are a team that has a lot to prove. They're a team that is incredibly hungry, and that, I mean, they haven't ever, to me, looked dispirited in this series, which, considering they've lost a couple games to the Nets, could definitely happen. So I think that I would have the Hawks, barring any injury changes, of course, or anything like that, I would have the Hawks as pretty heavy favorites, but not insurmountable. You know, it's not one of those 90-10 series. Maybe it's 75 or 60% chance. But, you know, I still think that the Hawks would have a pretty good chance of winning that series.
All right, another one slightly related to this with Toronto. This is from Scott Biallo. Dwayne Casey, yay or nay?
Okay, I draw coaches into three categories. You have the net positive, the like clear net positive guys, which are very, very few. That's the Popovich, Carlisle, Budenholzer group. Then you have a very small net negative group, which I will not name. And then you have an extremely large neutral group where, you know, they're around. Sometimes they're good, sometimes they're bad. You know, they're in that range. I haven't seen anything really from Dwayne Casey to put him in the positive group, but I'm not completely comfortable putting him in the negative group. So to me, any coach that's not a yay is a nay, in the sense that you might as well try for a yay, and you go for that and you do it. But he doesn't seem to be abysmal to me in any way. So it's one of those circumstances that if the right guy presents themselves, I definitely think you go for it. But you don't throw him out just to do it without having a clear vision in mind.
Their defensive regression this year was troubling.
Yeah.
That was the biggest feather in their cap to me, that they played real good defense after the Gay trade last year. And Casey also has had a nice defensive history, even going back to his stint in Minnesota, where I thought he got a raw deal when he got fired back, you know, during the KG era, and when expectations were kind of higher for that team. And so the fact that if your team's not defending, and they sure as heck didn't defend in that Washington series, and I don't think he made a lot of adjustments, they didn't show a ton of fight, some of that could be health. And he has them play a very scrambling defensive system that the Wizards were basically able to just carve up, and there weren't really much in the way of adjustments there. So I think ultimately he's not Ujiri's guy. I think that they might prefer potentially someone with a little bit more modern of a philosophy. So my prediction would be that they move on from him, especially if they do a pretty big roster makeover. But, you know, I wouldn't say that he deserves to get fired by any means. I mean, they're a team that met expectations this year during the regular season. And if you look at the talent on that roster, you wouldn't say they should be winning more than 49 games with that squad. So
agreed.
He hasn't done a bad job. It may just be the type of thing where they feel like it's time for a new voice. But so, you know, I think a lot of it just depends on what direction you want to go in, you know, and whether he's maybe willing to make some changes defensively or maybe with the assistant coaching staff. I might give him one more shot, and because he, you know, and I know Masai gave him a lot of credit for how good they were defensively last year. So I don't know that he immediately became a bad coach this year. They had a lot of personnel issues on the perimeter, and maybe you can argue that the system didn't quite fit that as much. They could have gone with a more conservative system, because when you had guys like Williams and Grievous Vasquez on the perimeter, the way their system was set up when they one guy would get beat, then it was a crazy system of rotations, and then other teams were able to find open shots very easily, and they have a lot of young guys who maybe weren't able to execute that system that well. But, you know, if he had a little better personnel on the perimeter, and part of that is just they don't have that defensively, as we've talked about in past episodes, maybe he might be able to do a better job. So I'm on the fence. I think I would lean towards keeping him, especially as, you know, relatively cheaper contract as well. But it also wouldn't surprise me if they were to move on from him.
Yeah, I think that's a fair way to characterize it. I don't think that he's going to go there, but what would you think if Tom Thibodeau ended up being their coach next year?
Yeah, that would be an interesting one for sure. He would be able to provide kind of what they need, and they've been able to be successful offensively, at least during the regular year, without a ton of complexity. I don't like the fact that they have a lot of pieces. There's not necessarily an obvious starting lineup and best lineup, and that's something that Coach Thibs has struggled with throughout his career, even going back to some of his best teams, those 2011 Bulls that started Keith Bogans. So that would be a weakness there, but I certainly think he could improve the defense for them as a new voice. All right, so we got time for one more here. And this is kind of an interesting one from EK Stewie. Is this the weakest East of LeBron's playoff career? It's interesting to note how few legit East teams he has had to go through. I do not think it is the weakest East of LeBron's playoff career. I would say that 2012 would be that for me. After Rose tore his ACL, they ended up playing a Celtics team in that was the number four seed and had a pretty mediocre regular season. And they were able to get past both Indiana and the Celtics without Bosch, essentially, basically with just Wade and LeBron, and that was about it. So I thought that was a pretty weak East. And I think you had another year that you thought was weaker, too.
Yeah, so I looked into this. I actually thought it was a really interesting question. And the year that was my first thought, and I ended up coming back to it, was 2007, the year that the Cavs made the finals and got swept by the Spurs, because that was a year that had a very weak top. So the Pistons had a shaky year. They won 53 games, and the Cavs dispatched them in six. But why I was thinking that was that it wasn't a situation where they got it kind of by luck with the Derrick Rose injury. The third place team that year was the Raptors, that were not particularly strong. I believe they outscored their opponents by about one point per game. And Cleveland didn't even face them. They beat the Nets, who weren't particularly good, and they beat the Wizards in a sweep, who, if I remember, that was the year that the Wizards had a bunch of guys that were hurt. So for me, 2007 was, and I would agree with you that 2012 was an easier road than this year as well. This Bulls team is definitely not perfect, but I think that they're a challenge, and while the Hawks have looked shaky, let's say, they're still a very good team. I would say this Hawks team is better than any of the teams on the board in 2007, and probably, and not as good as the Bulls, even though, but they didn't face those Bulls.
Yeah, I mean, this Hawks team did win 60 games. I would say that 07 was definitely better than the 2012 without Rose or Noah. Noah sprained his ankle really badly and missed the rest of that Sixers series too, and I think game three in 2012. That Pistons team had a down year that year, but they also had won 64 games in 2006, and then I think they went back up to 59 games in the following year in 2008, and people were talking about them giving that 08 Celtics team a good run, and they gave them a nice run in the Eastern Conference Finals, and that was the Pistons, I think, you know, fourth year out of the six consecutive that they went to the Eastern Conference Finals. So I think that team, although they didn't have a great record that year, you know, had a lot of institutional knowledge that made them a really good team. But yeah, I mean, I think this Hawks team, especially when they get their stars in, I think they're starting to find their legs a little bit, and they're going to be a challenge for Cleveland. I don't think that I'm not as worried about them as I was a couple games ago, because they found their offense again in these last couple of games. I think they're going to be a tough out for Cleveland either way.
Here's a question related to that. How do you, with, let's say Kevin Love is completely out, how would you compare this supporting cast, non-LeBron edition, everybody but LeBron on this team compared to his other Cavs teams?
Oh, you got to say it's worse. I mean, Kyrie is a better individual player, but those Cavs teams are awesome defensively. I mean, they won 66 games in 2009, and they won 61 in 2010. Those are great teams that ended up losing in the playoffs, and maybe they were too dependent on LeBron, and Dwight Howard was able to carve them up because they just didn't have anyone to guard him. I mean, in the clincher in 2009, he had like 45, just killed him. So, you know, and they got unlucky in a couple of games there too. You could also consider the fact that LeBron back in 09 and 10 was way better than he is now. People forget how incredibly awesome he was that year, or those 2 years. So I still think they might have actually had a little bit better of a supporting cast without Love, not offensively, but defensively. Those were some of the best defensive teams in the league.
I definitely think that's fair. Anything else that you want to hit?
Actually, there was one more question. We'll keep this one short. This is from Frankie Boy, Boy spelled with a zero, and two Ks as well. The Bucks became the percentage chance the Bucks become the first team in NBA history to win a series after being down 3-0. What say you?
My first instinct is like 15-20%. Does that seem about fair?
I'm going to go 10%. And let's say they have a 50% chance of winning on tomorrow, Thursday. And then if you go by the standard home teams in Game 7s win about 80%, that gets you pretty close to about 90% still for the Bulls.
Yeah, I think you can definitely, I think I was on the more optimistic side. But, you know, they've had a couple of good games.
Yeah, I mean, and the Bulls can't play this badly again, right? You'd like to think that. I don't know. We'll see. I mean, as I said on the last show, it's definitely going to be worrisome if the Bulls lose this game, and they're, it's going to be a toss-up. So we'll see what happens. That would obviously be a pretty epic collapse, and you would have to imagine would absolutely ensure the departure of Thibodeau, which seems to be considered almost certain in a lot of circles anyway. So hopefully for the Bulls that doesn't happen, but this Bucks team has played real well and they deserve credit for that.
Quick question that leads into tomorrow. Is tomorrow your most anticipated game so far of the most anticipated day so far of the playoffs?
Yeah, just because of that Spurs-Clippers game.
Yeah,
although I was probably more up for that game five with it being tied 2-2. Now I think it's kind of more likely that the Spurs are going to close it out here. And whereas I felt like game five could go either way and would be a big determinant, now I think it's kind of, you know, the Spurs are pretty likely to win. So I'm not looking forward to it quite as much as I was the last game, but this has been a wonderful series and can't wait to talk about it tomorrow night. So until then, thanks a lot. We're doing pretty well on iTunes, it looks like, thanks to your ratings and your subscriptions. So please keep those up for us. It helps us keep this on the air. Thanks a lot.